My name's Rob, and I get to discuss with you an interesting session today. I hope this isn't too dense. I was telling Bob this morning, this is one of those sermons where you spend so much time in it, you kind of get lost, you start to think it's normal, and after a while you got to pull your head out of it and go, is this actually going to be interesting? Can we actually sort of preach this, right? And is it going to be helpful? So I'm hopeful of that. But I'm going to pause and say a word of prayer, and then we'll get started. Lord, thanks for this morning. Thanks for all that you give us. I pray that you'd be with us this morning as we think and as we engage this material, as we recognize the beauty of your creation and the amazing potential that we have as human beings to create and to be creative, and at the same time, some of our vulnerabilities in those areas. We pray that you would help us as we focus on you this morning. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. I'm going to start with the ending, which is Matthew chapter 6, verse 33. Jesus says this, "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough worry of its own. Seek first the kingdom of God." That's where we're going to start today. Or that's where we're going to end today, but we're starting with it as well. So, right off the bat, I want to ask, have you ever taken a dog for a walk on a leash? This is, after a bit of training, it's a pretty nice experience, actually. The dog trots along, usually on your left side. The leash is nice and loose. He's paying attention to your cues for pace and direction. This is properly called taking a dog for a walk. Conversely, if you find yourself being dragged around by the dog, subject to all his whims and distractions, of which there are many because they can smell and hear a lot of things and everything is interesting to them, this is the image of an owner not in control of pace or direction. Their arms are outstretched, they're careening along, the leash is tight, and that's properly called the dog taking you for a walk. Now, in that scenario, the dog's not the issue. I think we understand that. The issue is the owner and his or her lack of ability to train the dog. That's more or less the issue. And so today I want to focus on, this is the second part of our series in this whole faith and tech sort of, how do we manage this stuff? Today, how do we use tech to enhance, enrich our lives and our ability to hear the voice of God, as opposed to being controlled and enslaved by it? And tech, to me, is a lot like money. It's just a thing. But we have the added challenge now of, I think, tech companies purposefully paying attention to human psychology to keep us hooked on their products. They kind of have to. They got shares and everything to keep going. But at the base level, a computer is just a computer. A phone is just a phone. A tablet's just a tablet. It's how they're used that it matters. So do we leverage them for our own personal and relational success, or do we let them run us into some kind of destruction? It's up to us to determine how much influence they exert on our lives and how much our devices and the experiences they mediate control our behavior and our mood. So we were asking earlier when we were thinking about this little series, if being addicted to gadgets, the internet, and technology is even a thing. And if it is, what it might look like and what the impacts of it that might look like and what are the options for change. And there certainly are some dependencies going on with some of these things that mimic but are different than classical addictions like drugs or alcohol. These are the media variety where we return to a software experience that feels good in the short term but can become problematic over time. So you have images, and this is no respecter of persons because we're all persons. And so you have images of the executive relentlessly checking emails. You have the teenager agonizing over Instagram likes, the lack thereof. The college student skips class to get in one more World of Warcraft quest. A new mom ignoring her newborn as she scrolls endlessly the dad that gets annoyed with his kids for distracting him, the couple who ignores each other and thinks texting equals communication. We're susceptible to these devices and these software products, and we want to discuss today how to place boundaries in place in order to avoid some of the more significant dependencies. Now, these devices and the software in them are indeed incredible. I've kept in touch with families and friends more than ever before, which was always a problem for me. My mom was just never happy that I never called her. And things like organizing events, it's pretty easy. You just have to pay attention. They can be leveraged in times to help in times of disaster. They've been instrumental in the overflow of various governments and the installation of presidents. They're powerful, but there's certainly room to accept that we do engage in use that's not helpful and sometimes even harmful to our lives, and that we do so when we shouldn't, like when we're driving or playing with kids or while we're at work. And the consequences for that can be massive. For example, phones and driving are incredibly dangerous. Being on your phone when you're supposed to be paying attention to your family has implications not only for your relationships, but their healthy development and the sense of self. Playing on your phone while on site can jeopardize your job. Some of these oil companies are doing us all a favor and banning them from use during work. Excessive video gaming can make you relationally impotent, financially dependent on your parents, depressed, and can impact your physical health. And so we've got all of these really powerful tools that are fun and engaging and connecting, and also can be destructive and can be not helpful at the same time. So we have some of these what I call ubiquitous images for our day. There's actually a type and walk app that makes your phone transparent as you walk along and use it, so you can avoid curbs and potholes and other people. seems ridiculous. I've listened to interviews with police members who say that issuing distracted driving tickets is like shooting fish in a barrel. They can just do it all day long, but they tend to have other things to do too. The gadget use in culture and in our general population is becoming more and more of an issue. People die senseless deaths all the time from distracted drivers. Kids don't need imaginations anymore because parents put screens in front of them at any given moment. Spouses play on their phones instead of talking or physically interacting with each other. Boredom is a thing of the past. Standing in line, not a problem. Get your phone out. Employees using their personal phones at work. Phones interrupting a perfectly good date. Kids complaining to therapists, and I hear this a lot. That their parents don't pay attention to them. They're constantly being told to hold on a second. More and more young people would prefer to play electronic sports than real ones, and countless others would prefer virtual girlfriends or boyfriends to real ones. Most people can't go 30 minutes without checking their phones, and a lot of people doing their checking is the last thing they do before sleep and the first thing they do upon waking. We're losing our ability to concentrate on anything and see a task through to completion. And we're losing our ability to derive satisfaction and fulfillment from work, relationships, art, music, and even the connection with God. And this sermon might be a little bit of an exercise in sustained attention. I hope it's not too long. And yet most of us sitting here thinking, what's this got to do with me? I limit my tech use. I only use it for business. My mom and dad want to know where I am. I only use Facebook to organize things. And that's okay, because denial is part of this whole picture, too. just to get a little bit technical here, there's a couple of things going on sort of physiologically that I wanted to review, because some of this I think is helpful. In my world, we use it's called the DSM. It's just a big manual of disorders that we try and sort of match diagnoses to treatment processes and stuff like that. It's basically the sum total of agreement in terms of psychiatry and psychology out there. It's not always agreed upon, but whatever. And they diagnose various mental disorders, and they also focus on things like drug, alcohol, caffeine as being chemically based dependencies. And the old language was dependencies or addictions, and more often they use substance use disorders. Those are kind of the Those are kind of the words we use, and mild, moderate, severe ones. So kind of on a bit of a continuum. But there's also recognized that there are some things like non-drug dependencies or behavioral addictions or process addictions, as we call them. They're not officially in the DSM, but we acknowledge that they exist. So you might hear things on the internet like internet addiction or gadget use disorder or sex addiction or exercise addiction, and officially they don't exist, but we realize that they're possible, right? We can get sort of dependent on some of these things, and even though they're not codified officially necessarily. So the neurobiology, though, of non-drug behavioral or process addictions do resemble, in a lot of ways, drug and alcohol disorders. These are disorders of, say, impulse control or compulsive behavior. Impulse control disorders are like stealing. You think of the celebrity who has all the money in the world and yet still finds him or herself in the news shoplifting. What is that about? It's got nothing to do with the money. It's got nothing to do with the item stolen. It's got everything to do with the excitement that builds with wondering if you're going to get away with it, and then the actual sort of planning, and then the actual pulling off of the heist. It's all exhilarating. And, of course, there's a letdown afterwards, and then you get some of these feelings of maybe regret or guilt and those kinds of things, and then potentially what happens is you come back into it from those feelings of regret and guilt and potentially come back into, well, how do we fix that? Well, we can fix that with the thrill, right? So anyway, stealing or impulse control is associated with activities that bring positive rewards. Something was gained. In this case, whatever gadget they stole, but also sort of emotionally. Compulsive behaviors are a little bit different. These are the cycles of behavior that are done to alleviate some kind of adverse stimulus. So if you're feeling anxious or down or stressed and you eat a donut and you feel better, the eating of the donut becomes compulsive behavior as the discomfort of the pain was reduced, or maybe if you ate too many, was increased. Let's just stick with one for now. Something bad was removed. Your feeling of feeling uncomfortable was removed because the eating of the donut was so pleasurable. And I think Timmy's injects their stuff with something to keep us coming back. I just haven't been able to figure out what that is. So first of all, I want to talk about maybe a little bit of definition. So what's a use disorder? What is an addiction? Now, for any diagnosis, you generally need two things, distress and disability. You need some symptoms, and then you need some functional impact. You need some things that are happening, but you also need it's getting in the way of your life in some way, shape, or form. And so I like this definition. A chronically relapsing disorder characterized by a compulsion to seek and take a drug or stimulus, loss of control and limiting the intake, and emergence of a negative emotional state like dysphoria, which is kind of depressed, anxiety, irritability, when access to the drug or stimulus is prevented. So for our purposes here today, the drug or the stimulus is gaming, emailing, texting, social networking, online shopping, online pornography, all of which is available on that small little device in your pocket that's got incredible computing power that we've never, seen before. But we're talking about excessive use that impacts normal functioning in your life, such as our relationships, child development, work activity, productivity, finances, either in the form of spending to maintain these habits or loss of revenue for actually engaging in revenue-generating activity. Low motivation, increased anxiety and depression symptoms. So these are all kind of what happens when you start thinking about what are the actual sort of symptoms, say excessive use, but what are the impacts? And that's the on all those things. So what are some of the basic mechanisms at play here? I'm going to start with Ivan Pavlov. And everybody who's taken a high school psychology course, oh my goodness, are we seriously doing Pavlov and Skinner? Yes. Because it's actually helpful. These guys, what Pavlov figured out, his dogs weren't that cute, I don't think, is he noticed that the dogs in his lab experiments that he was testing for something else would salivate when food was presented in front of them, which is a normal thing. A dog is going to salivate when food is put in front of it. So he called that the unconditioned response. You see food, you salivate. But he also noticed that if you ring a bell, a dog doesn't salivate. It just sits there and listens to the bell. That's what they call a neutral stimulus. It doesn't do anything for a dog. And so what Pavlov thought was, wonder what would happen if you could make a dog salivate by ringing a bell. Turns out you can. You can pair the two together, and if you do that a couple of times, pretty soon you take away the food, dog salivates to a bell. That's called a conditioned response. He made it happen, right? And this all becomes known as sort of classical conditioning. Now, there's a little bit of a simplistic way of sort of looking at human behavior. So, B.F. Skinner came along with his Skinner box. He took these ideas and expanded on them a little bit. Skinner explained a good deal of human behavior through the process of reinforcement or punishment after a given response. Now, every parent knows how to do this, or they should at some point. The basic premise is that behavior which is reinforced gets repeated. Behavior that's punished tends to get extinguished. Actually, behavior that's punished tends to get covered over and just put aside, and it'll come back, but look, that's a whole different discussion. There's two reinforcement kinds, positive and negative. I'm going to quickly review. Skinner put a hungry rat in a box, and it ran around, and when it hit a lever by accident, a food pellet dropped out. Does not take long for the rat to figure out how to get a food pellet. He goes over it, and he hits the lever. Okay? The consequence of receiving food each time they push the lever ensures that action gets repeated again and again. This is just basic. We just kind of know how to do these things. We go where the food is. The positive reinforcement strengthens a behavior by providing a consequence somebody finds rewarding. Talked about that before with the stealing. Presentation of something that feels good increases the possibility of a response. A negative reinforcement is a little bit different. These are not positive and negative in terms of evaluations as in good or bad. This is a little bit different. The removal of an unpleasant reinforcement or reinforcer can strengthen behavior. So the removal of an adverse stimulus is rewarding and can alleviate pain. What happened here was Skinner placed a rat in a box with an electrical grid on the floor that was uncomfortable to walk in, as you can imagine. And when it accidentally pressed the lever, the electrical current stopped. It doesn't take long for the rat to figure out that if he wants the pain to go away from stepping on electricity, he hits the lever. So he trained them to avoid the electrical current by turning a light on just before the current came on, and guess what the rat did? Went to the lever, hit it. I ain't experiencing that. I know what that light means, right? So the rat learns to press the lever when the light comes on to avoid the electrical current. Do you remember Raj from the Big Bang Theory? Big Bang Theory. He could only talk to women when he had alcohol in his system. This is an example of negative reinforcement because the social anxiety after consuming decreases after consuming alcohol. And then he can talk freely. Alcohol is the mechanism for him to remove the adverse stimulus, which is social anxiety, and so he's able to talk to women. And alcohol is Raj's lever. He escapes anxiety by pressing it, and in the process assures that it happens over and over again, right? And if you're in that kind of a loop, the alcohol dependency is on a fast track to becoming an actual thing. Now, when it comes to addiction, there's two forces at work. Either a positive reinforcer, such as something I gain, so I check my phone and I get a message from somebody, or a negative reinforcer, such as I check my phone because I'm feeling low and I see a message from somebody and that negative feeling goes away. Now, you might say I'm a human, not a dog, not a rat. I have a few more faculties at my disposal. I'm not subject to all these behavioral rules. I want to demonstrate a little activity for you. Some of you actually have my cell phone number. I invite you to send me a text. Let's see what happens. Maybe I have this on silent. I can't remember. Maybe I have no friends. Oh, did you hear that? Oh, sorry. I didn't need to have it right here. I heard it. Oh, here they come. Maybe I have lots of friends or somebody's just doing this repeatedly. Now, it is very hard for me not to check this. But did you notice? Okay, I'm going to have to shut this off. I got noises, I got bells, and I got lights. Now let's see what's going on here, because everybody in my email, oh my goodness. Okay, so just gonna mute those because I'm doing something important. As if those bells and lights don't have some kind of power, right? And these guys figured it out way back when, before computers were even a thought in anybody's head. I have learned that the lights and the bells mean that a reward is imminent. There's also the unknown. Who is it? What did they say? Did they just send me an insult? Some sort of witty comment? Probably Chris sent me an insult of some kind. He's making fun of my PowerPoints earlier. That's bells and lights. And that's the whole theory behind bells and lights. And this is taking us somewhere, I promise. Now, the next level, though, of all this stuff is something really fancy called the variable ratio reinforcement schedule. Now, this is why a slot machine is so addictive. Because every time you pull it, you have no idea if it's going to give you a win. But if you pull it enough, it'll give you a win. But you never know when it's coming. But if you keep at it, it'll give you one, right? And so you may pull it or press the button, whatever you do, six times, nothing happens. Seventh time, boom, you get a win. Ooh, right? So now I'm thinking, okay, I just need to pull this thing seven times. If I pull it seven times, nothing happens. I pull it 8, 9, 10, I get a win. Hey, right? Now I'm hooked because I only need to press it 10 times. Now this time, 3, and I get a win. Hey, that's neat, right? So this variable reinforcement where it's unpredictable and you don't know exactly when it's coming, but you know it is coming, right? It's not that you pull the lever forever and nothing happens, because that would just extinguish it, but you know full well that it's coming. Now, internet activity provides multiple layers of rewards, and this is partly why it's so powerful. You get rewards that are multi-layered and they're unpredictable. So, Facebook, for example, repeated and unexpected good news. Any kind of news, actually. You go in there, you look, and every time you check, you get a reward for checking because there's something different on there, right? You also get a reward for checking because it's probably some sort of good news. You know, your cousin had a baby, your parents are in Florida, or whatever, you know, all these kind of neat little things that happen. World of Warcraft, EverQuest, these give you constant rewards, basically they just never end, right? The behaviors, the unexpected rewards from the behaviors you engage in just go on and on and on. That's what keeps you coming back. Text. You get this little shot or this little release of dopamine just as it's coming or when you see the bell because you don't know who it's from, you don't know what they're going to say, and you need to check, right? So, dopamine. What's the deal with dopamine? You may have heard of it. It's a natural feel-good neurotransmitter. Your brain's composed billions of neurons, a cell unit responsible for moving information around via electrochemical signals from one to the other. And those of you who are smarter than I am and know more about this can explain it better, but this is how I'm going to explain it. The signaling can be even seen with brain scans. So these are pretty powerful little units. These cells have little arms and hands, technically axons and dendrites, that reach out and they touch other cells. Well, they don't actually touch because they send signals across this tiny little gap in between them. Which is really fun. What happens in the gap is what actually feels good and what we're going to be talking about. Because when dopamine gets released into that little gap in between, one of these neurons reaching out for the other, you actually feel it. So your brain is programmed to seek dopamine reward. Well, from and reward from all kinds of other transmitters too, but I'm talking about dopamine in particular. And you get a little shot of dopamine from learning things, from experiencing things, and from noticing things that are important in your environment. Brain releases pleasure when you learn and explore things. And the dopamine is the payoff that creates a reinforcement. And this can be negative too, as all drugs and behaviors with addictive potential act to release dopamine into the reward system. So what does dopamine normally do for you? What's its normal function? What did God set it up to do? Dopamine makes you orient to things that are important into your environment, like getting up, going for work, or having a meal. We need a couple of things, a kind of base as sort of human beings: nourishment, shelter, and to reproduce. And dopamine helps us notice when we find something important in the environment associated with these things. And so dopamine activates the brain system that encourages action and eating and those other things. And when you notice some food in front of you and you're hungry, you might see, say, a 20% increase in dopamine levels. When you take cocaine or an amphetamine, you get a 400% increase. It overwhelms the areas of the brain that orient you to things that are important. And it is, I'm told, quite the experience to have that much dopamine going on. So we have our natural reward systems that God created, intended. He built systems into us that would ensure humankind nourished itself, sheltered itself, reproduced itself by giving us pleasure when we do these things, thankfully. Otherwise, we wouldn't, and I think we would just kind of cease to exist if we didn't bother doing all those other things. Now, what happens in addiction is that the natural reward system is overstimulated and abused and eventually not as effective as it once was, leading to dependence on something else, like a drug or a social media app, to provide that function for us. In fact, it's been shown in addiction that we lose our natural reward system and gain a stress system that's alleviated by the drug or whatever else needs to sort of come in and do that for you. Now, this is just for fun. This next one, if you take science class at some stage, you'll have seen these little... These are the little fingers reaching out for other little neurons, okay? And in the middle of that cleft, what you have is it comes down from it's a cycle where dopamine gets released from the, in this case, the top one, into the synaptic cleft. It binds on a receptor on the other side. And when it's done, it comes back into where it went. And it gets taken back in by, this is a fancy word, the transporter. The transporter takes it back up and puts it back in the storehouse where it's supposed to be until it's needed for next little, you know, mission across the gap. What cocaine does is it blocks the transporter from pulling it back up so that the neurotransmitter stays in the cleft and you experience it again and again and more because it's not going back up where it's supposed to. Antidepressants work the same way in some ways. They block the uptake because it's all sort of off. But in this case, with addiction, is the transporter, cocaine plugs it, says, nope, those are staying down here. We are going to experience those till, and it's not good. So it overwhelms the system. This is a cycle that just is natural. It's supposed to keep going and it's supposed to just kind of go on and on. But drugs can... influence this, and you get an enormous reward for it. Now, there is such a thing as environmental triggers as well. Your brain starts to associate your reward system with drugs and alcohol, not only the drugs and alcohol itself, but everything else that's sort of associated with it. And so this is where it starts to expand into... we learn to associate other things while using, like people, places, internal states, smells, with the drug's rewarding effects, like bells and lights from Pavlov on your notifications. They can activate the dopamine system on their own and trigger urges to take the substance. So say you're trying to quit smoking, there's certain behaviors that are tied in. Like you smoke in the morning before breakfast, you smoke when you're stressed, when you're busy at work, you say, I need a smoke break, so you go for a smoke, and then you drive home and you smoke. These are all associations with smoking. So if you're trying to stop smoking, you got to figure out how to redo all that stuff. because you can't just jump in your car anymore and not smoke, because that's what you do when you're in there, right? The resistance to it is futile. With tech, it's more or less the same. If it's built into your routine, if there's certain activities that always involve it, if it serves as a stress reliever or a way to relax, if you want to lessen that addictive behavior with tech, you have to change routines, activities people usually do them with, and alleviate stress in other ways. You're going to have to control the bells and lights on these devices because our just sort of weak intention to change is no match for bells and lights. So I want to move quickly through the next bit. I think I was talking about sort of the stages of addiction. I'm not going to go into this too much, but basically most of you, a little bit intuitive, you kind of know this a little bit, where you have a binge stage, and then you have a withdrawal, negative affect stage, and then you have an anticipation, preparation stage, and anticipation, preoccupation, and then you get back into your binge stage or intoxication stage. It goes round and round and round. With addiction, this is a very powerful sort of cycle, and I'd love to go into it really thoroughly and sort of look at what all those do, but instead I'm just going to share an example with you. Here's how this works. You post something on Facebook. You can't resist checking for responses. I tried this on myself on Saturday. I posted something about food, which I never do, and then I did a food post and found myself going back every 30 seconds going, how come nobody's seen this yet? I think it's pretty interesting. How come I got no comments? Anyway, you're rewarded when you get responses. All of a sudden, you get a couple of likes, you get a couple of, oh, that looks disgusting, and that kind of stuff, and you're like, oh, there we go. We feel uneasy when we don't get any responses. What does this mean? Why am I being ignored? Do I have no friends? Is this not interesting? What's the, all this sort of uneasy sort of mess starts to go on. We start to check out other posts that are grand and witty and getting lots of attention. You feel worse as your life is obviously not as interesting. And so you decide to scroll for a few more seconds. And 30 minutes later, you come to and you realize you've been scrolling down into some kind of digital wormhole that you need to get out of. So you put the phone down and you do something productive like change the baby's diaper that he's been fussing about for the last 20 minutes. And you feel better. I'm not picking on moms, but I guess I did. You feel better for a while and start thinking about going to the store for some supplies. And then guess what? You see the little green light on your phone. And you start thinking, huh, who could that be? What do they want? Do they need something for me? Did somebody comment on my stuff? They need something. You think, maybe I should just ignore it and go to the store. But I'll check it quick and just see. And you come and you see some responses to your posts, so you read them all through and then you comment on some of those. And then some other notification alerts you, and 30 minutes later you come to, having gone down another digital hole. And you start to feel bad that you've been wasting all this time. You notice all through this there's feelings, right? You quickly scan the room, and all you see is a mess, which creates a bit more negative affect. And your brain says, answer the green light, and you'll feel better. That's the cycle. And you can get trapped in it pretty easy, and it's just what your brain is naturally equipped to do. So, whenever we work with addiction, we're always evaluating harmful effects. Alcohol, cocaine, effects are pretty tangible. Ruined finances, ruined life, ruined families, loss of jobs, poor health, loss of valuable friendships, this kind of stuff. Impacts of tech dependence are not as maybe dire, but they're certainly present, like impaired creativity and innovation. Anybody that is creative will tell you that ideas happen in the blank spaces between other things. We're just sitting there waiting for the coffee to brew, or you're standing in line, or you're laying on the floor in your kid's bedroom. That's when ideas float, right? That's when you get inspiration. Lack of social development. Instead of learning the skills of asking a girl out, you just swipe right. You don't have to go through all the uncomfortableness of figuring that out. Socials tend to scratch a social itch, but only enough to get you by. And they don't contribute to the richness of actual human interaction, and we learn, we don't learn how to do that well, and we're actually bad at it, because we don't do it. We remain disengaged from kids. Checking your socials while cuddling with your child on the couch doesn't count. You're disengaged. right? We have a lack of productivity. You could be working. You could be thinking of a new business idea. You could be developing something. You could be making money. But you don't. Most good ideas and projects that pay off financially require sustained attention. I had a mentor of mine tell me one time, I went through all 11 seasons of MASH once. It took me, upon reflection, I think I was depressed during that time, but it took me 3 months to get through all those because I had to go to work too. One of my mentors said, MASH fans don't write PhD theses because you're consumed with this other thing. You don't have time to sort of put into something else that's productive. Impacts on mood. More Facebook time equals more symptoms of depression. This is starting to come out more and more research-wise. Seeing somebody else's life filter through their chosen filter. Impossible to compare your miserable reality with their filter. And it tends to generate isolation. Not dealing with the negative emotional states, but just avoid them. You might be turning to tech to alleviate pain associated with living. Excessive use can be a symptom of underlying depression, anxiety, or excessive use can perpetuate symptoms of depression, anxiety. Other negative impacts. Distraction can be deadly. You can kill yourself, your family, or somebody else's kid while driving. You can die by walking into traffic, looking at your phone. This happens, you see that more in the cities where people walk in front of trains. Distraction keeps you disconnected from your values. I'm sitting trying to write this and my phone's going beep, beep, beep. I look at it. Hey, guess what? Donald Trump did something. And I go, oh. Wonder what it was. And then I try to go back with where was I? How do I? Okay, it takes me 5 minutes to get back into this, right? One of my favorite bloggers at the moment is a guy called Benjamin Hardy. He writes a little article called 35 Things You Need to Give Up to Be Successful. Number 17, continuing to be distracted. You've got to get a hold of that. Number 18, not realizing that focus is today's IQ. We don't just assume that you're able to actually engage in focus anymore. Our attention spans have shrunk to almost nothing, and willpower is atrophied. Develop some really bad habits. All this distraction can keep you from deep work. There's shallow work, pushing paper around, doing emails, logistical kind of stuff, doing receipts and whatever. Or there's deep work where there's actually creativity coming out and there's actually sort of you're in some kind of a zone. This constant state of distraction makes us less able to do that. And then, of course, there's security risks, which I'm not going to get into, but there's lots of people that are very good at luring people into doing stuff they don't want to do. So, how do we develop boundaries on all this stuff? A couple of things. You can't just roll back the clock 20 years. So it's really about sustainability, right? It's really about how do we use our tech because we still need it and it's fun and interesting and makes life sort of more engaging sometimes. But you want to avoid consuming it all day. Just a couple of things. I printed a bunch of this stuff out for in my references if you want to email me or something to get it. Or maybe I need Peter to make me a slow tech form of getting that. But there's a couple of things. Proximity. Physically closer something is to us, the greater effect it has on us. So we put it farther away, right? If you can't see it, if you can't touch it, so put your phone or tablet or whatever in the drawer for, in another room for 3 hours each night. Can't actually do that. That's called withdrawal, and you're starting to think about, okay, maybe this isn't a addictive kind of behavior here going on. For me, I leave my work phone in my bag down by the door. I silence it, and I actually forget about it. Now, if I could do that with my personal phone, it would be a whole other thing. But you want to dedicate a certain time of your day to no tech. A couple other things, like don't bring your phones into meetings. Communicates that they're not as important as who might try and contact you. And we stay disengaged until the actual sort of meeting actually starts. We do this, and then, okay, we're going to start, okay. And then, okay, we're done, and then we do this. And it's away from that sort of how you doing kind of stuff before it starts, right? Which is the actual sort of physical, relational engaging. Don't bring phones into your bedroom. Just get an actual alarm clock. You can get some sleep. Screens trick you into thinking that it's not bedtime yet. so it doesn't start into your bedtime sort of shutdown processes. You might actually talk to your spouse. Get an app to track your use online. There's actually apps that'll track how much you do this. Lots of different stuff that I don't have time to sort of go into all of these. But essentially, experience life in its real sense, as opposed to all its kind of pseudo connection. Small groups or community groups. Don't bring your phones. Why don't we just leave them in a basket or something? Instead of, you know, when we're trying to pray with each other, we're doing this. Right? Encourage, don't get annoyed with your friend who's taking a day of Sabbath from their tech. Why isn't he answering? I don't know, I just sent it 5 minutes ago. What's the problem? Dedicate times away from distraction. Accept that boredom is good for you. Practice good sleep hygiene. There's lots of stuff that we can go into with that. So anyway, I want to talk, at the end of all of this, I want to bring this down to how does this affect us, or what's sort of biblical component of all of this? Because we want to engage some of this from what does the Bible actually say about any of this? I thought long and hard. I could not think of an example or a person in the Bible that was consumed with excessive tech use. Except maybe a pharaoh somewhere, maybe was distracted with fulcrums and math and that, I don't know. But there is a constant exhortation to focus on what's important, to know what the big picture is. And we have to always take and evaluate our present with the basics, principles of Scripture like this one. Seek first the kingdom of God. The next one, who's your master? You can't serve God and money at the same time. Or you can't serve God and your tech at the same time. When you spend your day looking at what it is that fills your heart and mind and what comes out of it, if you fill your day with banality and superficiality, that's what comes out. No big ideas, no intelligent conversations, no real ability to engage God in relationship, no evidence or experience of the love of God. Love God, love your neighbor. Be filled with the Spirit, not the glow from your phone. Watch what you think. Whatever is true, noble, pure, lovely, admirable, think about that stuff. These are all the big ideas. You know, Deuteronomy 6, love the Lord your God with all your soul and with all your strength. The end of Matthew, go and make disciples. Are we doing any of this stuff or are we distracted? Right? We're in the way. And the last little thing I want to share with you is Sabbath. Exodus 20 says, remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. 7th day is the Sabbath, the Lord. On it you shall not work, you, your son, your daughter, male servant, or your female servant, your livestock, or the traveler at your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the 7th day. And the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. We don't have time to fully unpack Sabbath, but the principle is that we model after God and we rest on the 7th day, whatever that might be. We tend to equate Sunday with Sabbath, and that's fine. It works for a lot of people. But the concept is broader, that we set aside time from our work, from our play, from our tasks, to focus on worship. And we're out of balance when we allow tech, in our case, to keep us from fixing our eyes on Jesus. And so how do we do that? We got to, Sabbath encourages us to seek some balance, to rightly esteem where everything goes in your life. The technology that we have today and use is only going to get more integrated into our lives. We've got to keep thinking about this and keep it. I mean, one of these days, kids are going to make fun of us carrying phones around because somebody will have figured out how to connect our brains to the internet. Something like that. But what it behooves us to figure out what we're doing and why, and then use our tech to support that, right? That it's all about worship. How do we use these tools to make these things happen? A bass player I worked with years ago, he told me, I worship best with my fingers. I use the tool to facilitate worship. It speaks to taking time to rest and focus on God. Maybe you haven't had space to actually experience God lately. I know that happens to me a lot. And maybe it means incorporating Sabbath, spiritual discipline associated directly with tech use, because scrolling isn't Sabbathing. Watching isn't Sabbathing. Checking isn't Sabbathing. Resting isn't Sabbathing. Sabbathing is focused attention on God that reorients us to our actual purpose, our actual identities. Let's get intentional about using our tools to fulfill our callings instead of being governed by these little devices. Anyway, that's all we're going to talk about today. I know that's a lot, and I rambled a bunch of stuff at you today, but I appreciate you engaging in this exercise of actually paying attention for that long.